content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Virtuoso Life magazine and the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we are going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to take a look at the future of travel through the Sustainable Travel Report featured in the November-December 2020 issue of Virtuoso Life. Now, this is a travel industry publication aimed primarily at travel agents and travel planners. And from time to time, we have featured articles from Virtuoso and other publications about sustainable travel. In the first of two articles, we read from a conscious comeback as writer Marika Kane looks at travel in 2021 and beyond in hopes travel's return is good for the planet and good for people. The pandemic has thrown the travel industry's importance to local economies into sharp relief, and the crisis presents an opportunity to reframe the conversation around sustainable travel. This was the consensus at Virtuoso Travel Week 2020, the luxury travel industry's largest networking event. Rather than the usual 1,000-strong gathering in Las Vegas, this year's event was 1,000-strong virtually, with participants networking and joining presentations via video across time zones. One such offering, Under One Sky, a sustainable travel conversation, hosted by Virtuoso Vice Chair and Sustainability Strategist Jessica Hall Upchurch. And here are some traveler-relevant takeaways, so here's some things you might want to think about in future travel planning. Under-tourism is the new over-tourism. In previous years, ensuring that crowds of travelers didn't love destinations to death was a hot topic. This year, the conversation turned to the dearth of tourism, or as Virtuoso Chair and CEO Matthew D. Upchurch put it, an economic and conservation disaster. The global pause in travel has had wrenching effects on communities that rely on tourism, and that goes far beyond hotels. Penny Rafferty, head of the Sustainability for Tourism Australia, pointed out that across 19 Australian lodges, the Tourism Board identified 1,600 other businesses that were integral to the experience, from gin distillers to fabric makers and local guides. One positive is the commitment of many travel providers to supporting local communities during the slowdown, from hotels donating food to locals in need and housing first responders to tour operators bolstering their conservation efforts. It's time to reassess. We're going through a critical reset right now, said author, speaker, and entrepreneur Joel Makower. This crisis offers a chance to re-examine values and practices. Jessica Hall Upchurch pointed to the retirement of aging aircraft and ships that don't adhere to the highest environmental standards. For travelers, this moment is an opportunity to take a step back and reassess to seek out travel companies whose actions align with their priorities. Profit and purpose can coexist. Josh Kent, executive chairman of Tour Company and Beyond, said there's been a perception that you can't have a red-blooded capitalism conjoined with purpose. He stressed, "I want to refute that entirely. If you think you have to trade profit for purpose, think again." And Beyond is a case study in this concept, having consistently performed well financially while also investing in ventures ranging from land and wildlife conservation to building schools for communities in need. Joel Makower concurred with this playing out across other sectors as well. He said, "Wall Street finally figured out that sustainability is a proxy for good growth, management, and innovation. Sustainability has moved from the margin to the mainstream," he added. And travelers are driving this trend by demanding accountability and seeking out companies that put purpose at the forefront of their missions. Travelers can easily take action. Virtuoso travel advisor Deanna Brooke, who founded her company based on supporting sustainable travel, reminded attendees that travelers can start small with actions such as packing reusable items or swapping a short flight for a drive. "It's about doing what you can when you can," she said. Travelers can turn to their advisors to find experiences and companies that allow them to deepen a commitment to travel sustainability. Well, in the second article of the Sustainable Travel Report, again in Virtuoso magazine, writer Joel Centano is going to provide us with the latest in supporting local economies, celebrating cultures, and protecting the environment. So let's see what Joel says. And his first subtopic is by design. Fuji's Lucala Island reopens in November following a seven-month refresh. The 25-villa private resort wove sustainability and style into the refurbishment, reviving much of its traditional decor, including all of its magi work. Woven from coconut husk and restored by artisans from neighboring isles, the decorative sennets connect beams beneath the resort's thatched roofs, meshing with other ecologically sourced building materials, such as pandanus, leaf mats that are covering ceilings and walls. And then we have respect for architectural traditions helps ensure that ancient techniques are the forefront of Fijian sustainability, says Lou Najam, who co-manages the resort with her husband, Michael. But a sustainable aesthetic is just part of the Lucala's mission. Cultural education and connection are also critical, she adds. To this end, staff, 99% of whom come from local communities, lead guests through the Lucala's vanilla plantation, guide them in kava ceremonies, and teach them how to make candles, wellness products, and totes from island materials. There's an intangible takeaway, too. Fijians are naturally warm, sharing people, and that shines through all the interactions with guests, says Nijam. Now, many long-lasting friendships have been formed here between vastly different people from opposing cultures. Villas, by the way, start from $5,600, including all meals and beverages, 260-minute massages per adult, and activities ranging from snorkeling to sunset cruising. So quite a trip there, huh? Then the next topic is clean consciences. Hotels and cruise lines are turning to a sustainable Danish sanitizing technology to give travelers squeaky clean surroundings and peace of mind. The process, called Premium Purity, uses a two-step sanitizing procedure that employs a saline-based solution to kill microbes, including viruses, and a second formula that renders surfaces sanitized for several months and possibly up to a year. Among the early adopters, Big Sur's Post Ranch Inn, River Cruise Line Uniworld, Red Carnation Hotels, and Lindblad Expedition Cruises. Now we move to another topic, one for the ages. Even medieval Europe's mightiest fortress has required its share of makeovers. But following a series of facelifts that started in the 19th century and set the standard for many restoration practices, Malbork, Poland's 13th century castle, Castle of the Teutonic Order, now stands as a historic monument to conservation itself, this according to UNESCO. In 2021, travelers can check out the Gothic exemplar on one of the Seabourn's newest UNESCO-themed shore excursions. Partnering with UNESCO since 2014, the line aims to promote sustainable tourism at hundreds of World Heritage sites, from Cambodia's Angkor Wat to Australia's Great Barrier Reef. These tours offer a special cultural experience, says Kate Caruso, a Vancouver, Washington-based Virtuoso advisor, who visited Nova Scotia's Grand Prix National Historic Site with Seabourn. Anyone who cherishes travel's ability to deepen our appreciation of the world will have their journey enriched by these sites, she says. Tour Malbork Castle, along with Gdansk St. Mary's Basilica, on a day-long excursion during a 14-day Northern Europe voyage, and this goes from Rotterdam to London aboard a 458-passenger Seabourn Quest. And the departure date, by the way, is May 24th, 2021, and it starts at $7,299, and excursions began at $199. So it's kind of a la carte, if you will, in that kind of travel, just so you know, okay? And by the way, Seabourn tells us they have 470-plus tour options, 70-plus countries to visit, and their efforts have added $1.5 million to cultural preservation. Now, we have a little insight added as we read this article, and this is from Maya Santangelo of the Australasian Rolex Scholar, and she is a PADI instructor and undersea specialist with Lindblad Expeditions, and she writes this: "The opportunity to be in nature and feel small, whether hiking in a forest, zodiac cruising in a fjord while looking at a tidewater glacier, or snorkeling at a coral reef, is so important to bring us back down to earth, so to speak, and remind us that we're part of a larger system where our actions have impacts on things bigger than ourselves." Good point. Well, here's some news items that were added to this report written by Joel Centano. Now Hear This, the weekly Leave Our World a Better Place podcast from And Beyond, features the Safari Company's Champions for Conservation. So if you're interested in that part of travel, you might want to give that a check out and just Google And Beyond to find that podcast. With so many wildlife areas around the world facing increased pressure, host Cassia Slywa says, "We feel it's more important than ever for us to share their knowledge." In recent episodes, Simon Naylor, conservation manager at South Africa's Fenda Private Game Reserve, reveals how And Beyond transformed degraded farmland into a vast refuge for Africa's famed Big Five, and ecological monitor Charlie DeVoe speaks on her passion for saving endangered pangolins. "I'd like my children to see a pangolin one day, something so elusive, so rare," she says. "There's no other mammal like it." Find it on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or Google Podcast. And again, it's called And Beyond. And finally, then we have Quiet Time. Sounding off on late night noise, Budapest recently enacted a new quiet code in the center of its 7th district, known for its post-midnight party scene and surfeit of outdoor seating at restaurants and ruined pubs. The move follows similar measures to make life more tolerable for residents and low-key visitors in Hungary's capital, including stricter vacation rental regulations and calls for large cruise ships on the Danube to dock outside the city center. For additional peace and quieter imbibing, Susanna Sarman with the Hungarian Tourism Agency recommends visitors venture a bit beyond the city limits, beginning with the Ite Buda wine region, home to a boutique operation making lauded sparkling wines. Wow, isn't that amazing? And then we conclude with On Tour, Hope Takes Wing, and you'll see why it's labeled that in just a moment. The annual monarch butterfly migration in Mexico's central highlands is one of nature's most beautiful events, and travelers' journeys to behold this spectacle could be the key to saving the species. As populations decline across North America, sustainable tourism serves as the most powerful tool in conserving the migration event and the butterflies' overwintering habitats, says Court Whelan, Director of Sustainability for Natural Habitat Adventures and author of The Monarch Migration, A Journey Through the Monarch Butterfly's Winter Home. In 2021, NatHab, in partnership with the World Wildlife Fund, will host a series of tours to monarch sites. We recently spoke with Whelan to get his take on the program's power to lift up travelers, butterflies, and local communities. And here are some comments he made. "Seeing so many butterflies at once is like a monarch snow globe. It's breathtaking. It's visual and audible. The Monarch Biosphere Reserves are the only place I've ever heard butterflies. They sound like rustling leaves as they take flight by the millions." Can you imagine? And then we had the butterfly tourism is important because families have steadily encroached into monarch habitat out of necessity, having to create new farmland for additional food and income. Without ecotourism, I fear these forests would be lost, and with them the migration. Next point, local communities benefit because monarch ecotourism provides significant income to thousands of families. The entire community can gain financially and put more food on their tables than they can through the subsistence agriculture. Fortunately, ecotourism in the reserves is managed entirely by these locals. They serve as guides, benefit from park entrance fees, and work at and own businesses such as hotels and restaurants. "Expect this experience to make you an ardent monarch supporter," they write, "as well as a storyteller of one of the great generations on Earth." So lots of good information there about sustainable travel, if that's something that might meet your travel fancy. And we're going to be offering some more updates on sustainable travel in future episodes of Armchair Traveler. Next, we're going to feature writer Christopher Reynolds of the Los Angeles Times. He reports how a historic California mansion is getting a pandemic makeover, and his article appeared in the November 15, 2020 issue of the News and Observer. And the dateline is San Simeon, California. One recent morning, a dozen Barbary sheep started to shamble across the main road to Hearst Castle, then stopped in the middle. And why not? They hadn't seen a loaded tour bus on that road since March. As California wages a seesaw battle against the coronavirus, the castle's keepers confront the challenge of reopening a historic site that depends on bus transportation and has no air filtration system. Nobody is sure when California's most famous mansion will reopen, including Don Thelot, superintendent of the California State Parks District that includes the castle. The castle stands about 230 miles northwest of Los Angeles, halfway to San Francisco, a location that helped until now make it a prime tourist attraction for decades. At its Roman pool, where 1,800 tourists per day no longer pass by, the freshly scrubbed tiles have never looked bluer. In most of the compound's 165 artifact-filled rooms, there's less dust than usual because, as curator Toby Salim, or Sayim, rather, explained, there aren't visitors shedding dead skin as they shuffle past. Like millions of other homeowners who have been filling their pandemic days with long postponed household projects, the team on the Hearst Castle hilltop has a long list of chores. Workers are trying to revive and clone an ailing oak tree, to replace rusted iron with stainless steel wherever possible, and to power wash tiles to pluck ash from pool filters. They're also trying to calculate how many COVID-era tourists can safely fit on a 54-seat bus, perhaps 13, maybe 27, and how many can stand in the Grand Assembly Room where publishing magnate William Randolph Hearst once rubbed shoulders with Winston Churchill, Charlie Chaplin, Greta Garbo, Harpo Marx, Joan Crawford, and Cecil Beaton. The castle is really a 127-acre compound of buildings dominated by Casa Grande, the principal residence, whose exterior resembles a cathedral that's been smuggled out of southern Europe. Clustered around it are three guest houses, two pools, extensive gardens, and tennis courts, all surrounded by the blonde hills and stately oaks of the 80,000-acre Hearst Ranch, still owned by the Hearst Corporation. The visitor center is just off California 1. In normal times, 16 tour buses roll up and down the steep 7-mile road between the visitor center and the castle complex, with two departures every 10 minutes in peak hours. Now the buses sit idle at the bottom of the hill while the sheep, which prefer the high country, cross the road at will. The animals, a North African species known as the Audad, are descended from early occupants of Hearst's private zoo. The name goes for the zebra, or rather, same goes for the zebra, elk, and several other species that roam the ranch lands. Since the pandemic, you definitely see them a little bit more now on the road, Thelot said. They have a little bit more carte blanche, so to speak. At the Roman Pool, the spectacularly tiled indoor space that is the last stop on most tours, workers have partially drained the water, pressure-washed areas that hadn't been cleaned since the 1980s, replastered here and there and repaired glass mosaic tiles, and set about replacing rusty iron railings with stainless steel sleeves. The room's eroded cork ceiling tiles still need repairing and resealing, a tricky job because the tennis courts are just above. But the blue room, dusted with gold leafing and empty of visitors, shimmers like a mirage. Outside at the larger Neptune pool, where marble statues are gathered like a weekend retreat of Greek and Roman gods, it's been 2 years since workers finished a 4-year leak sealing project. But the nearby Dolan wildfire in September spent so much ash into the air and the pool water that workers had to double or triple their scheduled cleanings of the filter system. William Randolph Hearst, who inherited a mining fortune and built a publishing empire, launched his planning for the estate in 1919 after his mother's death in the influenza pandemic of 1918. He spent more than 25 years acquiring items, drawing and redrawing plans with architect Julia Morgan. The result, many experts have said, is a vast but disparate collection of European art and artifacts from many eras and locales displayed cheek by jowl. It was a fantasy project, says James Allen, public relations director of the castle. atop a 17th-century Italian dining table set for 22 in the refectory. Hirsch liked to keep bottles of Heinz ketchup and French's mustard at the ready, so they remain. Whether you consider this castle the realm of an unpretentious potentate or the kingdom of a kish, it's made for many entertaining weekends. Hirsch usually shared host duties with his longtime mistress, actress Marion Davies, while his wife Millicent remained in New York. When he left his castle in 1947 for the last time because of health troubles, Hirsch still viewed it as incomplete. He died in 1951. 7 years later, Hirsch Corporation donated the hilltop and the two-acre visitor center site to the state. Since then, more than 40 million tourists have come and gone. So that is a makeover in the making, and probably something to look forward to and part of your travels, maybe, if you head out to the West Coast anytime in the near future. Well, among the assets of travel, of course, are being inspired and uplifted. Writer Seth Boster of the Colorado Springs Gazette illustrates how this works in his story, Green Box on the Back, Woman Climbs All 54 Colorado 14ers. Now, this article appeared in the November 13, 2020 issue of the News and Observer. In mid-September, near the end of her mission to climb all of Colorado's 54 14,000-foot peaks, Brittany Woodrum thought she would come up short. Making matters worse on the snow-packed Crestone Needle was the wind that howled, throwing her off balance with a bulky green box strapped to her back. She and friends had to turn around. "It was really disheartening," said Woodrum, age 27. "That was the moment where I was really worried I might not get the needle this year. But as much as of a detriment as it was, having that box there was what always encouraged me to keep going," she said. "I knew I had a greater purpose for being out there." The purpose of her 14er mission was to raise funds for ShelterBox, the nonprofit sending the green crates packed with essentials around the world to people displaced by disaster. Woodrum is the organization's latest outdoor-driven ambassador to embark on a wild promotional trip while sporting the box. On a return to Crestone Needle, the last weekend of September, the mission was accomplished. Woodrum made one final entry to her journal, recording close to 550 miles on foot and more than 232,000 feet of elevation over the conquest that began with the Culebra Peak on July 10th. Woodrum went on to average 5 summits a week, according to the log. Atop the needle, she felt an immense amount of gratitude, she said last month, from Leadville, her home base for the adventure. 2020 has been very difficult for everyone, and this summer has been one of the best summers of my life. I'm just so grateful that I've gotten to run around surrounded by awe-inspiring nature. Another emotion I definitely felt was absolute relief and astonishment. I just can't believe I pulled it off. That was especially considering she had never hiked a 14er before. The soft-spoken Kentucky native originally intended to pursue her master's degree in humanitarian assistance at the University of Denver this summer. COVID-19 changed that. "Sitting in Denver and looking at the mountains," she said, "it seemed fitting to climb mountains as we as a community are kind of climbing this abstract mountain together." She had connected with ShelterBox, whose cause she found to be central to her own. Woodrum has mostly lived abroad in the past few years, embedded in underserved communities. "One stop was at the Buddhist nunnery. We had nothing to very little," Woodrum recalled, "and yet these women were some of the happiest I ever met." That experience, she said, prepared her to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail, which she finished in August last year. "And that prepared her for this summer of 14er," she said. "That's so many days you want to quit, but you find a way to put one foot in front of the other. That was my mentality." By the start of October, ShelterBox website showed her having raised nearly $75,000. Woodrum gained, too. "Sometimes I think we just get stuck in our own bubble. Especially with the COVID-19, it's hard not to be attached to your device and the news and think everything constantly in chaos," she said. "To go out and kind of escape and be surrounded by nature, it's really grounding in many ways." Wow. What a journey that was, huh? In the middle of all this COVID stuff. Well, let's round up our journey today with a little bit of a holiday touch. We're going to be reading excerpts from an article called Christmas in Namibia, Breaking with Tradition for an Elephant-Sized Gamble. Our writer is Heather Greenwood Davis, and the article is found in the November-December 2020 issue of Virtuoso Life. There are things that I could have anticipated bringing me joy in Namibia. Friendly people, a night sky with more stars than I'd ever seen in my life, the look on my son's face as he spotted hieroglyphics on a stone hill hike. My guide picking up a giant ball of elephant dung with his bare hands, breaking it in half and holding it up to me like it was Simba from The Lion King wasn't one of them, but there we were. A few years ago, my husband and I decided to skip our traditional big family Christmas at home. We were already a year-long trip with our sons, 6 and 8, that defied most conventions, so why not step away from the materialistic aspects of holiday routines while we were at it? Choosing Namibia was a no-brainer. The tiny, family-friendly country with easy-to-drive roadways was a low-key way to introduce the kids to the continent. It was a good plan until it wasn't. On Christmas Eve, the homesickness set in. There was no need to set out cookies for Santa, no snowy landscape outside our window, no giddy preparations for the morning ahead. On a call home to family, we could hear everyone gathering without us. And then we got the news that the elephants were gone. Long before we arrived in the Flintstones-esque location of Twyfelfontein, a World Heritage Site in the northwest of Namibia, the wildlife there stole my heart. December is the cusp of the rainy season, which should have meant that the animals were scarce. But we'd been lucky. Lions in Etosha National Park, giraffes and zebras on the edge of the Namib Desert, and antelope seemingly everywhere. But the elephants eluded us. African desert elephants can weigh up to 6 tons and stand up to 10 feet tall. You'd think they'd be hard to miss. You would be wrong. Elephants have quietly moved along the savanna, shying away from the open plains, intending to stay in herds along the periphery. I knew this because elephants are my favorite animal, and we've been looking every day since we had arrived. We hadn't seen so much as a trunk. They usually come down to the watering holes, but when it rains in the mountains, they don't need to, our stargazing guide explained Christmas Eve night as I grilled him for information. And when the rain falls, he explained, they're the first to stop coming down to wander on the plains. They stick to the puddles closer to home, far from the tourist who'd traveled across the world for a few moments of the elephant's time. It wasn't raining on Christmas morning. In fact, it felt a lot like any other day. The Merry Christmas greetings from staff and festive lights strung up around the dining room helped raise our spirits. The promise of a new day of exploring helped, too. The earth was red and scorched, and passing car could kick up enough dust to ruin a white T-shirt, but apparently it had rained in the mountains. We knew this because the elephants were gone. But at breakfast, our guide found me with a bit of news. People haven't seen many, but someone spotted a herd yesterday, he told me. Then perhaps, because my excitement scared him, he immediately backtracked. They've likely moved on. We headed out with renewed enthusiasm. This was our last shot. After Twyfelfontein, we would make our way back to Windhoek and out to the airport. Unless a wayward elephant found us en route, we were sunk. That's when a large ball of luck appeared, and it's how we ended up watching our guide sniff elephant poop like it was a delicate rose and hold it up like we'd found gold. He was so happy with himself in that moment that he didn't explain and seemed to mistake our horror for support. "It's still fresh," he exclaimed, while my husband and I exchanged looks that shared a silent prayer. We were making our own sandwiches that day, and then he said the magic words, and all was forgotten. They were here. The elephants were here. And sure enough, hours later, though we were still looking, the children had given up and were instead playing the game. But they kept looking, and they keep looking, according to the article, and they were able to finally see a herd. They saw a little baby elephant, then another, and as their eyes adjusted, they saw tusks and tree leaves, and wow, it was quite an encounter. They counted at least 9 on that particular day. Yet another wonderful story. And that brings us to the end of today's Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program intended for people who are blind and print impaired and is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments can be directed to 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.